So this is the second day of our June 2-10 Vimalakirti retreat. Some people come to a retreat like this with expectations. Some having to do with expectations about the retreat. And that's kind of the usual stuff. And the retreat unfolds the way it does. And then usually we see the foolishness of having our expectations and we get on with it. But some of us bring a more pernicious, painful kinds of expectations, which has to do with themselves, their own performance, how the retreat's going to be for them, and really, more importantly, how they're going to be in the retreat. And of course, we know how they think they're going to be. They're going to be all-stars. They're going to be meditation all-stars, mindfulness impeccable, constantly in a samadhi of instant delight, and having one enlightenment experience after the other. What a waste of a good retreat. No matter how often we hear over and over again, no expectations. Let go of everything. Just be in the present. Just practice ceaselessly, whether it goes good, whether it goes bad, whether you're a good practitioner, a lousy practitioner, who cares, and who's judging? You know the Zen mantra, don't know. It's a wonderful mantra. We think we know everything. In truth, we don't know anything. Right? I have no idea how my hand goes from down here to up here. It's beyond me to even understand how that could happen. And yet, somehow it does. Right? I don't even appear to be directing it, and yet it seems to be going like that. Right? I don't know what I'm going to say next, and yet words come out. I mean, this is such an unknowing, this life. How much more how things are going to turn out in a reality that has so many different variables, of which whatever I'm contributing is just so small. Things are what they are, and you are who you are. And Zen says you are a Buddha. Except we act like ignorant beings. Why don't we start acting like Buddhas? And I don't mean act be the most egotistical, self-centered, exploitative being around and outwardly put on a spiritual mask, but I mean in your heart, really embrace that awareness that I'm a Buddha, that I have a pure nature, and that I am who I am and things are as they are, and my job is just to be. And get over trying to be somebody else. Face it, we are not great spiritual lights, none of us. If we were, we wouldn't be here. Right? This is like the workhouse. As we hear in the Vimalakirti Sutras, you know, the great Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and practitioners, they're in magical realms, listening to talks by Buddhas, carrying jeweled parasols around. Buddhas are doing all these magical displays. Right? You know, that's where the professionals are. You know, we have to be satisfied, you know, with ourselves and light shows put on by fireflies, blue butterflies flying around and woodpeckers. But it's okay. This is our own Buddha land. You know, and there are beautiful jeweled creations, you know, spider webs with dew and the sun and everything is shining. Just have to keep our eyes open. We'll see all the manifestations of the Pure Land here. So please stop judging yourselves. Please stop judging others. We don't know anything. You look over there, you see how somebody's going through a tough time, and you know, an hour later they may be in bliss and you may be going through a tough time. And so what if they're going through a tough time? Tough times are part of life too, aren't they? And out of tough times come understanding, breakthroughs, transformations, right? Good old Sam over there had a heart attack, nearly killed him, and he's just, he's been as happy as a pig in shit ever since. What's good, we don't really know what's good and what's bad, do we? So when we talk about trust, trust in the Dharma, trust in the Sangha, trust in the teacher, trust in the Buddha, trust in the Triple Gem, faith, you know, these kind of words where you hear in Buddhism, it really means trust your own true nature. You know, trust the path. And just let go. Surrender. And you're not surrendering to some higher authority, you're surrendering to your own nature, to your own unfolding. And all you have to do is just nurture that unfolding. Right? Good dharma, good mindfulness, good practice, good food, good health, good caretaking, that's all. Good spiritual friends. And the ripening will occur. All this wonderful cherries, the cherry trees are giving us now. I mean, nothing extraordinary went into creating those cherries other than the cherries trees just received the kind of nutriments they needed this year, right? And without much effort, they produce their fruit. You know, for those of you who think you have to beat yourself up endlessly to produce your fruit, you're on the wrong path. You know, go down to Guatemala, you know, where they beat themselves during Holy Week in penance. I mean, if you're gonna take the penance path, do it right. You know, there are people out there who know how to do that path very well. Now, the Buddha opened up a different path. It's not a path of, certainly a certain degree of commitment, consistency, work. It certainly is. But he called his path the path of joyful effort. This is not the path of suffering. There are other traditions which believe that the spiritual path should be a path of suffering. That's the path of purification. And that's that path. That's a different path in this world. But the Buddha said, my path is a path of joy, happiness. My followers are happy people. We are the happy people in one of the sutras, he says. And he didn't say it, arrogantly, like we're happy and they're all unhappy. He just was talking about the kind of community that he was creating. And that if people were practicing his teachings and his practices the way he set forth, then they should be experiencing well-being. They should be happy. Doesn't mean, you know, big grin on your face all the time and giggle, giggle. It doesn't have to be that kind of happiness. Jokey, jokey. It's a well-being. As Thich Nhat Hanh said, it's the half smile. Everything's all right. Everything's good. Even with birth and death and change, it's good. Somebody wrote me a note wondering why Vimalakirti is an admirable man, inspiration, but this person was bothered because he distanced himself from his wife and children. It sounds too easy, certainly not practical for us. Again, I really don't have the insides on his relationship with Mrs. Vimalakirti. Children, maybe there's another unexpurgated version of the sutra which has Mrs. Vimalakirti's take on what it was like to live with him. I don't know, maybe he was not the easiest man. You know, it's interesting. We don't know anything about relationships either, do we? Right? Let's say he had a relationship of distance, whatever that means, from his wife and children. But if they were happy together, and if they were supportive of one another, who are we to judge? What do we know about relationships? Do we have a certain view that a relationship has to be a certain way? That's a good relationship? No. You know, what does it say in the first page? Carol knows. What does it say, Carol, about views?
There is no view of phenomenon to be entertained.
All right, thank you.
No view.
No view. Thank you. No view to be entertained. But we are always entertaining views as if they're truth. As long as the relationship is productive of well-being, as long as the relationship is not productive of suffering, then who are we to say what type of relationship is right or wrong, good or bad? And yet we judge. We are so arrogant. We think we know everything. As I say, I don't even know how my feet go up the stairs. But somehow they do. I don't tell them to. Right. Zoe, what was your... Zoe said she asked a question in sharing. What did you say? I don't remember word for word, but it was like a question.
Do bodhisattvas skip?
Do bodhisattvas skip? And what else did you want to know what they do?
Do bodhisattvas sing out loud?
Do bodhisattvas sing out loud? What else?
Do bodhisattvas laugh too loud?
Do bodhisattvas laugh too... Just those three? Skip?
No.
Skip? Let me get it.
Bodhisattvas sometimes drink too much.
Oh, and they drink too much. All right, so there are four.
Questions.
All right, let's get... The first one again is, do bodhisattvas sing out loud?
Skip.
Skip. Okay. Do bodhisattvas sing? Do they
laugh
out loud? Too loud.
And sing out loud.
And do they drink too much?
And drink too much. Occasionally.
But your real question is what?
First of all, we didn't mean all of the same.
Yeah, I... your real question is what?
Is there any hope for me?
Again, you know, of course, bodhisattvas do everything. They do everything but cause suffering. to themselves in Xinjiang. That's what they've given up. But again, you know, we are somewhat distorted because we have a view of Buddhist practice, which is often monastic related. So, you know, you see what we say. I mean, do people drink too much and get tipsy and talk out loud in retreat? Well, obviously not. You know, I mean, it's a silent retreat where there's no drinking and we're silent. So, but you know what I'm saying? Or does that go on in the monastery or whatever? Well, actually, if you go to, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh monasteries, they do carry on a bit. But he's got an unusual monastery, which is much freer, so many of them, they don't. But again, you know, the bodhisattva precepts are, again, precepts founded on wisdom, precepts founded on, again, doing no harm, precepts founded on compassion. They are not, you know, minute controllers of behavior. That is a lower path. In lower paths within Buddhism, the focus is all on codes of behavior, highly regulated. And you know, there are reasons for that path of renunciation and of strict discipline. But obviously, you know, you even get that in Vimalakirti. It says, because it really goes through, you know, he's everywhere. You know, he's in all the good places, and he's in all the not so good places. He's in the high places, but it says his outward conduct is not, you know, is his mind is always impeccable. He is always there cultivating highest wisdom. He's always there to help beings. And that's the bottom line. And as bodhisattvas, that's as followers of the bodhisattva-yana, the way of the bodhisattva, that is the focus. Right? The other is easy, you know, because it's all about acting. And our transformation should not be external. Our transformation should be internal. And in the course of personality development, we're all different. Some may be louder than others, some may be more retiring than others, some may have a ribald sense of humor, somebody may have no sense of humor. I mean, it's just the way it is. We don't have to be a certain way. But what we have to be is authentically ourselves. So if we find, well, I don't know, I'm just saying, yeah, I'm always cracking jokes, but I realize that's really because early on I developed, you know, that was my way of kind of, you know what I mean, there's a kind of a dysfunctional and healthy way behind it, so somewhere along the way some of that personality stuff may fall away, just because it's really not authentic. But on the other hand, it could be that this is the way I am. I'm just a loudmouth, you know. No offense. you know what I mean? And again, I mean, that makes life interesting, right? That makes life fun. I mean, having lots of different people and lots of different who express their humanity in lots of different ways. And again, you know, diversity is good. So lots of hope. Vimalakirti. So in the last paragraph, of when all the bodhisattvas had all told their story, it says, in this manner, the various bodhisattvas, one by one, described to the Buddha some past encounter with Vimalakirti and praised the words he had spoken, on that occasion, and all declared that they were not competent to visit him and ask about his illness. At that time, this is now the fifth chapter, inquiring about the illness. At that time, the Buddha said to Manjushri, Manjushri, as we said yesterday, is a bodhisattva of wisdom, you must go visit Vimalakirti and inquire about his illness. Manjushri replied to the Buddha, world honored one, that eminent man is very difficult to confront. He is profoundly enlightened to the true nature of reality and skilled at preaching the essentials of the Dharma. His eloquence never falters. His wisdom is free of impediments. He understands all the rules of bodhisattva conduct, and nothing in the secret storehouse of the Buddhas is beyond his grasp. We didn't know that the Buddha had a secret storehouse. I mean, this is so wonderful, isn't it? The secret storehouse of the Buddhas. He has overcome the host of devils. Devils is really, I mean, again, this is all translation. These aren't devils in the Judeo-Christian sense of... devils in Buddhism are really forces of ignorance, maras, forces of delusion like that. He has overcome the host of devils and disports himself with transcendental powers. In wisdom and expedient means, he has mastered all there is to know. Nevertheless, in obedience to the Buddha's august command, I will go visit him and inquire about his own. So you see, as I said, this is a drama, right? And now the drama is moving. We have been, we've been at the Amra, where the Buddha is gathered with all this host, and all this miraculous stuff has gone on, and now the scene is going to move toward Vimalakirti's house. Then the bodhisattvas and major disciples in the assembly, the Brahmas, Indras, four heavenly kings, all thought to themselves, now these two great men, Manjushri and Vimalakirti, will be talking together, and they will surely expound the wonderful law. At that time, 8,000 bodhisattvas, 500 voice hearers, and hundreds and thousands of heavenly beings all decided at once they would like to accompany Manjushri. Those were different times. Angie and I were just at her uncle's house, who is a University of Alabama supporter, and he was very proud that University of Alabama was now has built a new football stadium that used to hold, let's say, 70,000, and now will accommodate 100,000. We live in different times. Right? Alabama playing Florida, there'll be 100,000 people. All right, Vimalakirti and Manjushri having there'll be about 10. Right? Exactly. So you can see different times. Eh? You would think just having, listened to all the bodhisattvas and disciples talking and seeing the Buddha with the parasols, and they would have had enough. But they love it. They love the Dharma. And, when Manjushri and Vimalakirti are going to be having a little Dharma combat, because they know something's going to happen. it's not a get well card experience. So it's maybe times will change one day, and because it is changing. I mean, I the Dalai Lama speaks in Radio City Music Hall just a few weeks ago, and I think somebody said there were 3,500. Thich Nhat Hanh was in New York. So when I speak, 1,200 or something came, or something, or a couple thousand came to his major talk. So things are changing. Things are changing. There is interest in these kinds of subjects of Dharma. So Manjushri was this throng of bodhisattvas, major disciples, heavenly beings, reverently surrounding and accompanying him, proceeded to enter the city of Vaishali. Now at that time, the rich man, Vimalakirti, thought to himself, now Manjushri is coming with the great assembly. At once he employed his supernatural powers to empty the room, clearing it of all its contents and his attendants, leaving only a single bed on which he lay in sickness.
Did you say using his supernatural powers?
Yeah, of course.
I thought he was a layperson.
He is. He had supernatural powers. There's hope for you, too. Not only can you become fully enlightened, but you can have supernatural powers. You won't have to do your own cleaning anymore. But I think this is wonderful. Because, most times when someone's coming to visit us, we what? We clean up, we get out all our finery, right? We want to make a good impression. But Vimalakirti's a man of Dharma. Right? Another way to look at this is all the accoutrements and all the furnishings of the house are all marks and characteristics, style, form. Right? They're meant for something. A lot of people buy things for effect. They're trying to create a certain effect, a certain look. Or they want to let people know, how wealthy they are, or something like that. What a good sense of design they have. I mean, a lot of people in their homes and their furnishings want to make a statement. Right? But Vimalakirti is a man of Dharma. He doesn't need anything. Right? He doesn't need any marks. He doesn't need to impress. And plus, he's being visited by Manjushri. Right? So he gets rid of all this stuff. A Dharma friend is coming. And Vimalakirti is willing to meet him, not quite naked, but close. Right? Just in an empty room, in a single bed, right? And he's laying there in the sick bed. I think it's a very powerful statement. And I think what it says to us is, are we willing to go through life like that? Right? Are we willing in our encounters to be so naked and open? And just to be willing to leave behind all our identification. I'm a this and I'm a that. Again, a lot of times when you meet people for the first time, they kind of tell you who they are by, their work and their degrees and their status. You know what I'm saying? Vimalakirti, he's willing just to be himself in an empty room. He even gets rid of the servants. I mean, he doesn't need anything. It's a very pure encounter. There's no need for anything else to support it. So this is the setting. Manjushri, the great bodhisattva, coming with this great train of, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and Gandharas and Devas, they're flying in the air. You know what I mean? It's just parasols and flutes. I mean, it's just, there's Vimalakirti, right? In this empty room, sick in bed. Courageous man, unafraid, not needing to make an impression. Maybe that's what I'm trying to say. Are we willing to go through life without needing to make an impression? Does Vimalakirti really care whether anybody likes him or dislikes him? Thinks he's got good taste or bad taste? Thinks he's rich or poor? So he's a man of Dharma. But also he knows Manjushri is a man of Dharma too. So he's showing him respect. Let's get everything out of the way. So just you and I can talk. So Manjushri entered the house. He saw that the room was bare of contents, with just one bed. Vimalakirti lying alone on it. This could be a play, couldn't it? You can see Manjushri walks in. There's Vimalakirti, the lights on Vimalakirti in bed. Vimalakirti said, "Welcome, Manjushri. You come without the marks of coming. You see me without the marks of seeing me." Have you ever been greeted that way? This is Vimalakirti. He doesn't hold back, does he? But he's acknowledging the profound, you know, that someone who's entered the room who understands, who's entering the room also in total presence, in total awareness, without any marks of any idea of coming or going. There's no marks. You come without the marks of coming. You see me without the marks of seeing me. So he knows that Manjushri totally here, has no awareness that he's come from anywhere. He's just present. And when he looks, he just looks, and he's not thinking that I see Vimalakirti, right? There's none of that going on. This encounter, we could say, is taking place in the now. No coming, no going. What's that song? No coming, no going, no after, no before, right? Like that. So this is how it's lived out. Welcome, Manjushri. You come without the marks of coming. You see me without the marks of seeing me. No separation. Manjushri said, "Just so, layman. What has already come cannot hardly be coming. And what has already departed can hardly be departing. What do I mean? What comes has nowhere it comes from. And what departs has nowhere it goes. And what is seen cannot be further seen. But let us put that aside for the moment." So these are two profoundly awakened beings, and they just kind of do a little, not sparring, but it's kind of like they can you see they set the ground. No coming, no going. We're just here, totally present, totally awakened. No marks of anything, no past, no future, no coming, no going. What has never come can't depart. What hasn't been born cannot die. Right? Like that. Very free. But yet, as we see, because form is emptiness and emptiness is form, things are and are not, as we say. There's also, we could say, in the world of bodies and relativity, something happening, right? So they first establish the ground of the absolute, right? No coming, no going, no after, no before, no health, no sickness, all is. Everything is just what it is. Is that clear? And having established that ground, you know, we could say having established the ultimate ground. Then he said, but let's just put that aside for the moment. And Manjushri says, layman, this illness of yours, right? Can you endure it? Is the treatment perhaps not making it worse than better? So obviously, Manjushri has had some medical experience here. And again, we don't know what the medical treatment was in those days. Leeches and bleeding and all that. So obviously, Manjushri is concerned, both for the illness as well as the treatment. The world-honored one, countless times, has made solicitous inquiries concerning you. That's the Buddha. He's saying the Buddha has been asking about you. He's concerned about it. Layman, what is the cause of this illness? Has it been with you long? And how can it be cured? So again, you know, he's asking outwardly practical kind of questions. But he's also, I think, this is like a little bit of what's called Dharma combat. He's testing him. Right? What is the cause of this illness? You know? Has it been with you long? And can it be cured? You know, we might ask ourselves for our own illnesses, physical as well as emotional, our own delusions. What is the cause of our illness? Has it been with us long? And do we believe it can be cured? These are good questions. Vimalakirti replied, this illness of mine is born of ignorance and feelings of attachment. Because all living beings are sick, therefore, I am sick. It's a very famous line in Zen. Because all living beings are sick, and therefore I am sick. If all living beings are relieved of sickness, then my sickness will be mended. Why? Because the Bodhisattva, for the sake of living beings, enters the realm of birth and death. And because he or she is in the realm of birth or death, he or she suffers illness. If living beings can gain release from illness, then the Bodhisattva will no longer be ill. So we get a very wonderful view of the life of a bodhisattva and the view of a bodhisattva. We are all interconnected, aren't we? And because we are all interconnected, we all share, in a certain way, a common condition and a common fate, right? And if you think about illness and disease, that which is called illness and disease, it's just something we just pass around among each other, right? That's all it is. And even though Carol is trying to get us to use the sanitizer, you know, the cleaner down there, right? To try to minimize the way we pass around disease, we'll still pass it around, right? There'll be another way. And human beings have been passing around disease and viruses and all these things for a long time. We could get out of it, couldn't we? We could wall ourselves off, or we could go to another realm. But the Vimalakirti says, why am I sick? Because all beings are sick. And bodhisattvas have made a commitment to stay in the realm of human beings, which means to stay in the world of sickness, to stay in the world of birth and death, to stay in the world of old age, aging. You know, so usually we get sick and somebody says, you know, we were always, I got sick because I saw such and such a person. Or I was flying on a plane and I must have picked something up there. Or I was at somebody's house over the weekend and they all had colds. Or right? We talk very specifically. But Vimla Kirti sees the bigger picture, doesn't he? I'm sick because all beings are sick. Because there's just so much sickness in this realm of life. And we just pass it among each other. And because I am willing to live my life with all beings, I know I'll get sick. It sort of comes with the territory, you could say. When we get sick, we're not like this, right? We're angry. We're disappointed. I shouldn't be sick. Not me. Right? Everybody else should be sick, but not me. Either because I deserve always have a healthy body, or I have important things to do in life. You know, I can't. Not me. But Vimla Kirti, what does he do? We know he had a lot going on in his life, right? He gets in bed. Takes care of himself. I'm sick because all beings are sick. This is just a condition of life. But what is feeding so much of our illness, both physical, emotional, is our delusions and our attachments. Can that be? What is the relationship of our ignorance that causes us to perceive our bodies in a certain way, in our life in a certain way, that we create illness within ourselves? You know, we know these days in the world of psychosomatic illnesses and so much, we know that mind states have so much to do with illness, don't we? But this is something that was known thousands of years ago. Right? And only now is medical science beginning to pay some heed to the effect of mind states, emotional states, lifestyle choices, etc., may have something to do with disease. Right? As long as we live in a world where so many people don't take care of themselves, right? As long as we live in a world where so many people don't take care of other people, we know there are so many diseases that so many people suffer from in the world that medical science already has cures for, doesn't it? And yet, we don't take care of each other because we're sick, because we're ignorant, because we live in the delusive sense of just our own individuality and our own self-interest. Right? We don't see our commonality. You know, it's he's saying, I'm sick because all beings are sick. Why, you know, all the environmental catastrophes that we're beginning to experience, including things like global warming, I mean, you know, why? It's because of all beings. We are ignorant, and we are greedy, and we suffer from self-interest. And we're unwilling to see the bigger picture in our own interdependence. And so therefore, we suffer. But can you see? We will suffer too. Even though there are many people in here who might think, but I'm environmentally correct. Right? I drive a hybrid. Right? I have an on-demand hot water heater. I have solar panels. We're like that, aren't we? It doesn't matter. We will suffer too, as long as all beings are steeped in ignorance. But that's okay. Because that's our job. Right? If Vimalakirti is not going, you know, all these sick people around, they're all passing around their disease, slobbering, you know, they don't put the sanitizer, what's it called, the sterile, what's that stuff called? Sanitizer, cleaner, you know, they're not washing their hands carefully, you know, they're not coughing in the correct way. I mean, what are you going to do with these sentient beings? Vimalakirti, this is the realm we're in. You know, in Buddhism, as you get in this Mahayana Sutra, you know, where all these tens of thousands of beings from other realms, you know. The interesting thing is, you know, in the earlier, description of all the people who were listening to the Buddha, you know, at the end of the whole description of thousands of this other, that, you know, then there were the monks and the nuns and the laymen. If you look at this description here of who went to Vimalakirti's house, the fourfold Sangha didn't go. So we don't live in a very enlightened realm. In traditional Buddhism, there are endless worlds and endless realms, which you get, you know, from this sutra. In a sense, you know, we are not the only form of life, intelligent life in the universe. But having said that, it is usually considered that this human realm is a mixed bag. And I don't think I have to tell you that. If you just study human history, you see what a mixed bag it is. Or if you pick up your newspaper every day, you realize just all kinds of people up to all kinds of stuff. Right? And not to say there isn't great goodness and good people in this world. Living good lives, living kind lives, living compassionate lives, and caring for one another and caring for the earth. But at the same time, there are many, many people who are stupid, dumb, just running around, you know, following their basis instincts. There are many people just driven by desire for power, fame, and glory, and celebrity. There are many people who are pursuing paths of great cruelty and violence. Right? I mean, it's a mixed bag, this human realm. There are not a significant number of highly evolved people. You know, it's kind of a mathematical quotient, but it's and that's just the way it is. I think the purpose, not just of Dharma in the Buddhist sense, but Dharma in the kind of religious sense, is to, I think traditionally when you go to the founders of all the religions, the masters, we can see they were trying to take their hearers, their followers on, up the evolutionary scale. But we see how distorted human beings are, that their baser instincts went out, right? So we see today these teachings of so many of these great masters from thousands of years ago are now forces of delusion, right? Spreading intolerance, hatred, it's justifying violence, and I mean it's sick stuff. That goes on, very, very perverted, this world of ours. But again, I don't say that with any despair. Right? When you go into the hospital, right, do you expect to run into healthy people in every ward? And you'd say, no, that's silly, right? When I go to the hospital, I expect to run into sick people, right? And if you are a healthcare professional, you know what your job is, right? Whether you're the doctor, the nurse, the occupant. occupational therapist, the radiologist, right, whatever you're, right, you are there in some way to help. Whatever your skill is, you're there to help people who are ill. This is the way, you know, this is what Vimalakirti's up to in Vasali. Vasali, the town of Vasali, is his field of endeavor. It is his hospital. And he's going from room to room, from ward to ward, helping, healing, supporting, transforming. That's his job. And he's delighted that a brother in awareness in the Dharma is coming to visit with him so they can have a nice deep talk. You know, you see, he gets rid of all the furniture. Right? The town council comes, you know, he's got all the furniture out, right? Right? You know, because that means something to those kinds of people. Very impressive, Vimalakirti, he's a rich man, right? And so he uses his marks to do whatever good he's trying to do, because he knows those kind of people, that means something to them. And so we know, you know, sometimes to have a MD or a PhD or a BA or an MA or all these kinds of things often means things in this world, right? And so, you know, we take on these marks. We also know they are not always necessary, not always that meaningful. And so he's happy when Manjushri comes. Put the furniture away, cover it up. A real friend is coming who's not impressed by that kind of stuff. Right? That's a real friend, right? Because she is in the realm of birth and death, he or she suffers illness. If living beings can gain release from illness, then the bodhisattva will no longer be ill. It is like the case of a rich man who has only one child. If the child falls ill, then the father and mother too will be ill. But if the child's illness is cured, the father and mother will be cured. The bodhisattva is like this. For he or she loves living beings as though they were his children, her children. If living beings are sick, the bodhisattvas will be sick. But if living beings are cured, the bodhisattvas too will be cured. You ask what cause this illness arises from. The illness of the bodhisattva arises from their great compassion. You ask what causes this illness, what cause this illness arises from his great compassion. So you can see that the illness of an awakened person, and that means all of us have that potential, is different than the illness of an ordinary. You know, an ordinary person, when they're sick, has a very narrow view of what caused the illness and are only concerned about their own recovery. But the bodhisattva understands the bigger picture of things. And when they are ill, they are still happy. Many of us, when we're ill again, we are not happy. Right. Because the bodhisattva understands, I willingly take on this illness because I have freely chosen to stay in this world where sickness is. Do you see the attitude shift? Right. It's not about purity. We're all in this together. And to be all in it together means we are all in it with all types of people and all types of situations. Many people, they look at the news and they look at the political back and forth and they go, I don't want any part of this, right? Or I don't want any part of these people. A couple of weeks ago I was invited, there's somebody in our Sangha in St. Pete who's very active in the local Unitarian Church. And I guess once a month they have a guest. I don't know, what do they call him? Pastor? So, yeah, they invited me. And after it, talking to a group of them, and they were talking about, I think the annual convention of the Unitarian Universalist Churches this year was being held in, is it Arizona that just has a thing with immigration? And I guess there was a turmoil, a discussion of whether they should cancel to make a statement to the either the people of Arizona or the politicians of Arizona, you know, that stance they made on immigration. And so they asked me about it. And my response was, no, I don't think you should cancel. Because if you cancel, you only harden positions. And if you cancel, but they said, but it's only economic pressure that will probably change things. But I said, if these people of Arizona change things because of economic pressure, that doesn't mean they've changed their mind. You know, you've won a short-term political victory. But I said, spiritual activists are in it for the long term. And if you want to transform people, if you want to change people, you have to be willing to go to them. You know, you have to be willing to go to Arizona and talk to them and try to understand them. You know, these aren't evil people. These are human beings just like ourselves. And they have a certain view, right? And I don't know what that view is coming from. Mistaken, or maybe, you know, maybe we don't know their situation, right? We don't know why, what is driving them to see things this way. But before I renounce them, I would want to understand them, to show them the respect that we would hope they would show us if they disagree with our views. But we live in a time where we don't talk with one another. We don't want to understand one another. You know, we don't ask, tell me about your life in Arizona and why you feel this kind of action is needed. Right. Is that clear? Because if we want, if we really want to transform the world, we have to be willing to engage in the world as it is. You know, it's easy to be pure, to be right. We feel so good being right. And I was among people at the church. They were really good people, but I could tell they enjoyed being right. You know, having the right view. And that all these other people were all wrong. And the trouble is, those people on the other side are the same way. They think they're right. Right? And all the other people are wrong. And those are the seeds of war. Those are the seeds of violence. It begins with that unwillingness to dialogue with people who are different to you, to see their side of things. Unwillingness to accept that these people are in our world too. Right? We share this world. And if we're not going to destroy it and blow it up or just end up always slaughtering each other, we have to be willing to talk to one another, to try to understand each other. Right? And it's like, it's easy, when we do our deep share in the afternoon, because, we're all sort of somewhat similar, right? So this is just practice. The real test is, are we willing to listen deeply to someone who's totally different to us, sees things totally different, and find there and listen deeply enough? Because I think if we, again, I don't know much about the situation in Arizona, but I would imagine if we'd listen deeply to them, we would find fear. Right? We'd find fear. We would find anger. We would find feelings of helplessness with the situation that's occurring that they don't know how to deal with. All feelings that we know. But again, we don't listen, we don't dialogue. We litigate. Right? We litigate. Obama sends his attorney general out there, rather than going himself and saying, let me talk to these people. Let me listen to them. What are their concerns? What are their fears? What are their angers? What is life like for them there? Right? And all sides, not just, what I'm saying? And when we can do that, we will have a different world, won't we? Until we begin to do that, we will continue to have this kind of discordant, conflict base. We just reinforce, and the people on the progressive side do it too. We just reinforce duality and separation. We are unwilling to see that people who see things different from us are our brothers and sisters. Manjushri said, layman, why is this room empty and without attendants? Now again, he's just, this is Dharma combat now. Vimlakirti says, the lands of the Buddhas too are all empty. Manjushri says, why are they empty? Vimlakirti says, they are empty because of empty. Manjushri says, and why is emptiness empty? It is empty of distinction. Therefore, it is empty, he replied. Can emptiness itself be the subject of distinctions? Asked Manjushri. Distinctions, too, are empty, was the reply. Are you clear? So, this humble room is empty, and these miraculous Baroque lands of the Buddha are empty. Why are they empty? Because of emptiness, Vimlakirti says. And why is emptiness empty? Meaning, what does that mean? And he he says, because there are no distinctions. So this is important. Again, you've heard me say many times, emptiness is even though it has become kind of favorite word for translating shunyata, the Sanskrit word shunyata. But unfortunately, as most of us know, emptiness in English means sort of like we would say, "Oh, this room is empty; it's just space." You know, when we think of the word empty, we think of kind of empty space, right? And so I think when people hear emptiness, they think that that's unfortunate because it just builds up a false view. So what Manjushri says is, emptiness means emptiness of distinctions. So when you see this room as woman, 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 cushion, mat, floor, teacher, students, lights, stained glass, you know, you're seeing everything as what?
Distinct.
Separate. You're focusing on distinction. But if you make no distinctions, you have no labels, you have no conceptualization, and you see things just as they are, then you have emptied the room. And you see, you cannot create your stories, your judgments, your evaluations, unless you begin with distinctions, characteristics. This whole gigantic world we build up in our heads all begins because we think these characteristics of things, of phenomena, are real. It's all made up. This is not a flower. What is it? Can you see it without calling it anything? Can you free this from the tyranny of distinctions, from the tyranny of marks and characteristics? The truth is, this is you. You are the flower. I am the flower. The flower is us. But right away the mind goes, no, no, that's not true. I'm over here. It's over there. My name is Fred. It's a flower. Right away, we have to throw up distinctions, separation. So then Manjushri asks, how then is emptiness to be thought? And he says, it is sought in the 62 erroneous views of the non-Buddhists. Now that is an answer. Erroneous views. I'm sure they're listed. If not here, there is a... Oh, 62 erroneous views. A term denoting all views other than the correct view of selflessness. Okay. But I am sure that they are listed somewhere, knowing the Buddhists of old. So emptiness is in the 62 erroneous views of the non-Buddhists. And how are the 62 views to be sought? They may be thought in the emancipation of the Buddhas.
straight out of your
is that what Manjushri said then? What the hell is that?
No, these guys are going toe-to-toe. Isn't that wonderful? So, emptiness can be found anywhere.
I couldn't hear you.
Emptiness can be found anywhere. And even in the distorted views, the erroneous views, they too are what? Empty. Emptiness, lack of distinction, lack of permanence, lack of duality is present everywhere. It's not just present on the good side. It's not just present on the pure side. It's not just present on the spiritual side. It is present everywhere. It can be found everywhere. And to make a strong point, he says, yeah, seek it in the most distorted, perverted view. It is there too. Nothing is real. Nothing is solid. Right? A correct view would be what? This is a flower. Right? But I say, no, this is a piece of shit. Right? And you might say, this is a flower is a correct view. This is a piece of shit is an erroneous view, right? And yet the truth is what? This is still this. It doesn't matter how you view it. Reality is reality. That's what he's saying. If you want to see the truth of things, let go of views. Right views and wrong views. We might say in the realm of views and the consensual reality that the view that this is a flower may have a more consensual agreement than this is a piece of shit. But can you see? In terms of our capacity to see the reality of this, it doesn't matter your view, does it? It just gets in the way. Calling it a flower gets in the way. Calling it a piece of shit gets in the way. Forgive my language. Is that clear? And to disabuse people of the notion that truth is only found in correct views, right? Because what's the truth, Carol, about views?
There is no view of phenomenon to be entertained.
At all. And that cuts away our clinging to our correct view. So again, these types of sutras are wonderful. They are very deep and true. How are the 62 views to be sought? These are the erroneous views. They may be sought in the emancipation of the Buddha. The emancipation of the Buddhas. Because it means when the mind is totally emancipated. Again, that emancipation of the Buddhas cuts through wrong views and right views. And how is the emancipation of the Buddhas to be sought? It may be sought in the minds and actions of all living beings. And you ask why I am without attendants. But in fact, the whole host of devils and non-Buddhist believers are all my attendants. Why? Because the host of devils delight in the realm of birth and death. And while the Bodhisattva is in the realm of birth and death, he does not scorn their company. The non-Buddhist believers delight in various views of reality, and the Bodhisattva knows how to remain unmoved by such views. And why does the Bodhisattva remain unmoved by such views? Why can why can Vimalakirti go into the bars and saloons and brothels and gambling halls, right? With all those lowlifes, right? Because he's unmoved. He doesn't judge, right? He doesn't judge them. Doesn't see them as dirty or lowlifes at all. He just sees them as sentient beings. And whatever view they carry about what will bring them happiness or well-being, it doesn't affect him. Why does it affect him? Because he knows the truth. He knows the viewless view. Right? We should be like that. Too many of us are affected by the moods and the views of others. Right? When I say we don't know our own mind, I don't mean we don't know the truth of our own reality. We don't know it well enough. You know, there are many in the Zen Dzogchen tradition, you'd hear teachers say, this is the truth. And if you find out that it's not, chop off my head. You hear those statements. My own Dzogchen teacher said that to me once. You practice it. You'll discover this truth. If it turns out differently, come back and chop off my head. If I've told you an untruth. That's a pretty confident statement. But it's like that. You want to, in your own practice, reach a place of confidence. Where you know the right way. You know the truth of how to live and how to create happiness and well-being and meaning in life, right? And if you're around people who see things differently, that's fine. But it doesn't affect you, it doesn't distort you, it doesn't bring you unhappiness or despair or frustration or anger, right? Like that. In the same way, you can be around environments that are somewhat toxic, we could say. If you have that kind of surety and confidence, you won't be brought down. You won't be toxified. You don't need to worry like that. It's like it's like people in recovery. If their recovery is strong, they can go into a bar and they don't have to drink. They're not because they're strong. Their recovery. But if their recovery is weak, they could be brought down. So they should stay out of bars. And it's the same way in our own recovery. As we, in our Buddha, in our Sangha, in our own recovery movement, to recover our basic humanity, following the Buddha's 8-step program, of recovery. We should reach that same kind of surety about our path, about our understanding. So we can, in the same way, someone who is strong in their sobriety, in their recovery, has the capacity of being around drunks all the time and addicts all the time, and are only there to what? To help and to lead them into the path of sobriety. In the same way, we should be like that, right? We can be around people who are highly deluded. We can be around people who are totally lost in egocentricity, totally lost in sensuality, totally lost in delusion, and just banging around this world, just creating one miserable experience after another. You know those kind of people. We should be able to be around them and not in any way affected by them, but only from our compassion find ways to be of help to them. I mean, that is what bodhisattvas are capable of, and that's what they do. That's what they do for a living. So we will stop here for today.